Hello, this is Mark Shanton for Theatre Voice. There are currently an unprecedented 24 musicals running in London, and in the busiest autumn for new productions in memory, we've already reviewed Wicked here on Theatre Voice. Today, in an all-musical special, we turn our attentions to four more that have arrived in the last month. Three of them hail originally from Broadway, while the fourth has come to us by way of Australia. Spamalot, of course, has its origins in a low-budget 1975 British film, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, from which it is, in the words of the poster, lovingly ripped off. But as reimagined as a big Broadway musical last year by original Python Eric Idle, who's written the book and lyrics and co-written the music with John Dupre, it has become something else again. Set in 932 AD, it's a big, irreverent spectacle, as much an adult comedy pantomime as a Vegas-style floor show musical that filters the quintessentially silly English humour of the Pythons through a self-referential lens of the Broadway musical itself. Tim Curry, returning to the London stage for the first time in over 20 years, is reprising his Broadway turn as King Arthur, alongside fellow Broadway original Christopher Sieber as Sir Dennis Galahad, in a cast that also includes Hannah Waddingham as the Lady of the Lake, Tom Goodman Hill, Robert Hands and Tony Timberlake. Meanwhile, another Broadway classic, the 1966 Candor and Ebb musical, Cabaret, has been filtered through a new English creative lens by director Rufus Norris, continuing the honourable tradition of British reinvestigations of this fabled musical that saw London's last revival of it by Sam Mendes at the Donmar Warehouse in 1993 propelled back to Broadway. Norris, who directed the stage adaptation of Feston and is here directing his first musical, has fielded a cast that includes another musical virgin, Anna Maxwell-Martin, as Sally Bowles, James Dreyfuss as the MC, Michael Hayden in the role of Clifford Bradshaw that he also played in the Mendes Broadway version, and Sheila Hancock as Fräulein Ensteiner. At the National, Tony Kushner's partly autobiographical story, Caroline or Change, set to music by Janine Tesori, has come from New York's Public Theatre, where it was originally premiered in George C. Wolfe's production in 2003, before transferring to Broadway in 2004. Wolfe reprises his directorial duties here, as does Broadway actress Tonya Pinkins in the title role of the maid of a Jewish household in 1963, Louisiana. Finally, also set in 1963, Dirty Dancing puts Eleanor Bergstein's screenplay for her 1987 cult film on stage in a production that originated in Australia last year, and once again stars former Australian ballet principal Joseph Brown as Johnny Castle, the dance instructor who courts Georgina Rich's Frances Baby Houseman, both horizontally and vertically, at Kellerman's Holiday Camp. I'm joined by critics Charles Spencer, Matt Wolfe and David Benedict to discover which of these shows they enjoyed. Charlie, I think it's fair to say you did enjoy Spamalot.
Yes, I did, very much. I liked it on Broadway and I really liked it in the West End, which I think it really is its true home. Although there are a lot of Broadway jokes, but it is essentially a pantomime, this show, I think. And it was really rocking on with the audience, and I took my son and my wife along. My wife liked it less. And I think it's a very blokish show, this. And I think it's a... I've got a theory that what everyone should do is this Christmas is that the dad should take the male children to Spamalot and the mum should take the girls to Dirty Dancing.
Indeed, Dirty Dancing is often regarded as the
girly movie, yes. And, no, but I just think it's great fun. I'd sort of gone off Monty Python. I mean, they were sort of around on the telly when I was at school and loved them. And then by the time I got to university, you always had these sort of hairy physicists doing the parrot sketch in the JCR bar and things, and it really put me off. It seems to be a comic cult that attracts people without a sense of humour. But I watched the film before going to see the show in Broadway, and it didn't make me laugh at all. I just thought it was really rather laboured, this. But there is something about doing it live in front of an audience that really brings it to life again, I felt. And I just think it's, you know, it doesn't pretend to be anything more than it is, which is very silly and very entertaining. Though I do think it does offer the best pastiche Andrew Lloyd Webber we've had so far, with the song that goes like this, and Hannah Waddingham is absolutely fabulous, I think, as the Lady of the Lake. But great fun, but no more than that, but done just right, I thought.
Of course, we don't have the parrot sketch, but we have pretty much everything else from Python. What did you think, David?
I went, like Charlie, not really expecting to enjoy it much. I completely agree with the hairy physicist thing. I also think it's profoundly straight, and I don't know whether it was because I was gay or whether I was a wrong time, wrong place, but I used to not like Python. I think the surprising, or perhaps not the surprising thing, the thing that really makes it work on Broadway is Mike Nichols. You know, Mike Nichols, great, great comedian, great, great director, actually takes that material and kicks it into shape. My big problem with Python was always, that's a really funny idea. Why has it gone on three times its natural length?
Very true.
And Nichols cuts to the chase, and it's much tighter, much leaner, much swifter, and it doesn't sit around being terribly pleased with itself. However, imagine my surprise when, having enjoyed it that much on Broadway, I came to see it in London and thought, well, okay, I won't have the joy of discovery, but I'm going to have a good time. And I took along someone that doesn't go to theatre that much but loves Monty Python. He sat fairly stony-faced, and so did I. I thought press night performance was really lacklustre. Tim Curry was basking in his own self-approval, had nothing like the zest and the dry wit of Simon Russell Beale, who I saw on Broadway. I thought it was very flat, apart from Hannah Waddingham, who was fantastic. And Tom Goodman-Hill does quite a good job with Lancelot. But
and the French Taunter.
And the French Taunter. Now, and then, you know, he's a very good actor. Unsurprising, he's good. But, I mean, I got really confused at one point because I thought, where's the David Hyde Pierce character? And I realised he'd been on for about 15 minutes, but Robert Hans just doesn't know what to do with the character. It feels like this has not been directed by Mike Nichols. This feels like this has been directed by the staff director, who's getting everybody to do a carbon copy of what they once saw, and as a result, it's not nearly as funny.
And it hasn't been topped and tailed merely by Mike Nichols. Tim Curry, of course, had done it for a long time in York, and I think there were signs of wear and tear. He's gone a bit lazy. What did you think, Matt?
Well, yes, I mean, we're talking about the element of self-satisfaction that is, you know, possible with this sort of material. And actually, I found a slight degree of that to Tim Curry's performance on Press Night, that he seemed just a tiny bit smug, which is not what you want with material like this. I saw this at one of those, and anyone who knows Broadway will know what these are like, one of these kind of glorious Wednesday matinees when the reviews had just come out. It was clearly headed for the Tony. Everyone was very up. Everyone was, you know, in the show. There were no understudies, and it was just buoyant, a souffle from beginning to end. And this was at a Wednesday matinee, and by comparison, I found the press night here a fallen souffle. And I felt even Tom Goodman-Hill, I have to say, who to me wasn't a patch on Hank Azaria, it seemed like the sort of C team had been kind of enlisted. And actually, although Charlie says its natural home is the West End, well, kind of yes and no. I mean, some of the numbers, everyone who is aware of the show knows that there's a number about You Won't Succeed on Broadway Unless You Get the Jews, which here has been changed to You Won't Succeed in Showbiz Unless You Get the Jews, which doesn't really make any sense on any level in London. And in fact, the English non-Jewish friend of mine who I went with turned to me afterwards and asked me if I was offended by the number. And I said, well, no, but I can't imagine in New York the question even being posed. So it seemed to me that something has vanished in the transatlantic crossing.
I mean, it's interesting, the show I think it pays most close tribute to is, of course, The Producers, the 2001 adaptation of a Mel Brooks film. And that, I think, transferred much more successfully, yeah, for my liking. I mean, it's just a much funnier show, I think. I mean, comedy's always going to be personal, isn't it? And it is interesting what you said, David, about a straight take. I mean, straight American men particularly seem to adore the show. In America, the show Python is even more popular than he is here, hasn't he, Matt?
Well, yes. I mean, I remember when I was at boarding school, and we had a Latin teacher, Mr. Eccles, who used to greet every class with coconut halves. And so we would literally begin every Latin lesson with coconut halves, and that was a defining aspect of my adolescence. So, I mean, I knew the material inside out and backwards. Apparently, somebody told me, whether this is true or not, I don't know, that the show in New York hasn't had a lot of repeat business, which is interesting, because normally when you have a very successful musical, like Wicked is a classic example, you have people who go to see it again and again and again and again. And I now feel, having seen this twice, that I don't need to see it again.
I certainly agree with that. I mean, I think you're taking it too seriously in a way.
I was really up for a good time. I just thought, I really didn't think, oh, well, you know, I need to see the semiotics of representation. No.
I just wanted to laugh.
I wanted to laugh
because you'd both seen it before. And had you been seeing it fresh? Because certainly my son was hugely entertained by it, and it didn't seem quite. I've been to far deadlier press nights than that.
I really wanted to laugh, but I was just aware, and you know, you can't explain these things, but I was just aware of the smile on my face not becoming more than
that. Well, maybe it is what you say, it's a one you know, it's a show you only need to see once. And I have to say, I did thoroughly enjoy it here, and I don't normally enjoy shows particularly when I've got to write an overnight on them, and it just, it really tickled me all over again.
But I do think it has some enormous ramifications for its long-term run. As you say, musicals work on repeat business. You don't go and see a play and go, I'm dying to hear that speech again, it was so fantastic. But actually, the only thing that really made me want to go back again would be to hear Hannah Waddingham doing the song that goes like this, or indeed any of her material.
Well, I'll go again. I might go again, actually, to see Simon Russell Beale.
Absolutely.
Who my parents saw in New York, and they didn't see Tim Curry, and they said it was just glorious.
I saw Simon Russell Beale on Broadway, and I thought he was terrific.
Yeah.
I mean, much less lazy than the Tim Curry.
They may well be saving the best till second on this occasion. Yeah.
Who takes over in January when he finally leaves the National.
And he'll get the reviews all over again, because there's nothing else to review in January.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
A good point.
So, on to Cabaret, which has also divided the critics, I think. Charlie, again, this is one I think you liked again.
I did like it, but in retrospect, I'm liking it less. I liked it at the time. I think it's interesting, and I think it was a brave performance from Anna Maxwell Martin. Is that her name?
Yeah.
And actually, not unlike Jane Horrocks's, actually, in the Sam Mendes production of 15 years ago. In that, it was absolutely faithful to the original Berlin Tales, and she wasn't a very good singer, and I did find it very touching, her neediness and her flakiness and the fact that she really was sort of, you know, she wasn't all there, and she was out of her mind on drugs and drink, and she was a victim, and I thought she got all that all very movingly. And I quite liked the production. I thought the production was sort of was interesting and really hammering home the Nazi stuff, which I think was fair enough. But actually, deep down, I want to see Liza Minnelli doing it.
Of course, the Liza Minnelli shadow hangs over this part indelibly. But of course, you know, it's a totally different take as a stage piece. And they added new songs for the film, which they now interpolate into the stage version. What did you think of this production, David?
I too went along thinking with this, I'm really interested to see this. Rufus Norris is A, extremely musical. He's done fantastic work with avant-garde choral outfit, The Shout, who are fantastic. And he's done extraordinary stage work. And I cannot tell you how disappointed I was. I felt this was a really interesting essay about trying to put on a production of Cabaret that was not like the original. Or rather, not like the movie, not like what people think Cabaret is. One of the reviews said, this rediscovers Cabaret as political. That's like discovering Purcell's washing powder. Of course it's political. It's one of the best musicals ever written. It's incredibly strong on specifics and detail, all of which have been taken away from this. You don't get a sense of context. The interior scenes, you're not really sure where they are because the geography doesn't work in terms of the set. The club looks more like a dance studio than it does look like a club. None of this production seems to really add up. You've got fantastic choreography by Javier de Frutos, which makes you think this club is really ritzy, really clever, really smart. And then you've got, as Charlie says, you've got a Sally that's true to the books and is not a good singer. So, but you think, well, what's she doing in a club where the dancing is that good? Now, it sort of doesn't cohere. There are lots of really interesting ideas. I also think that this is a show for critics in which we can assess the different variables and variants that have been come up with by the production. When it doesn't deliver the show, and interestingly, it was booed one night during previews. I suspect that the previews were massively changing, and it's not fair to judge a show on that bit of hearsay. However, I don't think the show delivers, and if you're paying 50 quid, I'm not saying that there has to be all teeth and smiles, but actually you have to deliver more of the show than this production does.
I heard lots of very bad things during previews, and the word of mouth was terrible. So when I went on the first night, I was really very pleasantly surprised. I found it a great surprise, and I really enjoyed it as a result. But that's the negative working against it. What did you find, Matt?
Well, it's interesting. I sort of did an about-face on it as it was happening. At the interval, I thought, this doesn't work. It's not landing. It seemed very sort of precious. And rather, David, apropos of what you were saying, I'd read, I think, a comment from Rufus Norris where he said, well, we've discovered the darkness in Cabaret. And I thought, well, it's never vanished. So what if you've discovered something that's always been there? Hello. And I know there's this British penchant for darkening every musical on earth, but some musicals don't need to be darkened. This is dark already. But actually, The second act, I thought, worked very well, and two things were interesting to me about it. One was it seemed to be a cabaret in which Sally Bowles was a supporting character, which is fine, and I was very moved by Sheila Hancock, terrifically moved by her, who was far and away the best Fräulein Schnatter I've ever seen, and I was surprisingly moved by Michael Hayden as Cliff, who I thought was also far and away the best Clifford Bradshaw I've ever seen. And the very final image, without giving too much away, I thought kind of took the ending of that show on somewhere different to a way that, at least to me, generated a genuine frisson, and I was surprised by that.
I agree. I think that final image is brilliantly done, particularly since it corresponds with something at the end of the first half.
Exactly.
We don't want to give it away.
Right.
And I think it was actually, as David was saying, the dancing is absolutely knockout, isn't it? I mean, and very witty, because instead of using bentwood chairs like Fosse did, you know, they use...
It's all beds.
You know, new beds. So I thought that was a very, you know...
That, you know, that's the design motif for the show. We have upended beds in the club, and they use them in many guises.
Yeah.
And then the beds are flattened in order to be in the boarding house.
Yeah, I thought that worked really well. And it's got great style, and I didn't feel it overplayed the darkness particularly. I mean, they always say this, don't they? I remember... Heightness, when you did Carousel, it was going to be dark. Mendes said Oliver was going to be dark. They all feel this strange need to say it's
Mary Poppins
dark.
Is
Poppins
too dark.
But I think it's not quite the cabaret of one's dreams, but there's no doubt that it's consistently interesting, I think, and it held my attention throughout. And
I think it tries to do one very fascinating thing, which it doesn't quite pull off, but I sort of applaud the effort, which is, David was talking about context, not quite knowing where you are, which I agree with, but I think Rufus Norris wants to give you a sort of hallucinatory sense of the period as this kind of dreamscape turned nightmare. And I think that's a rather bold way to approach it. I'm not sure he pulls it off, but I like the idea.
Yeah. I think that the best thing about the show is Jean Clément's lighting. And it creates kind of echoing pools of purple loneliness. I know that sounds like a very purple phrase, but that is actually what's going on. You know, you do get these, because Katrina Lindsay's set sort of opens up the stage, rather unatmospherically, it does at least allow him to create a kind of grey, strange chilliness, which plays well with the ideas that the production is pursuing. But I do come back to the fact that, like Matt says, I think the show's been rebalanced, but not in its favour. To have Sally as a minor character is problematic. And also, if you're going to put in songs from the movie, if you're going to put in maybe this time, you know, for which there is no excuse other than you want to do it because it was in the movie, she's not singing that in the club. She's singing that back in her room. It has to be, a full expression of how well she can sing, not how much she can belt. You don't have to do it like Liza Minnelli, who was brilliant and utterly wrong. You spent the whole of the movie going, she's great, but what's she doing in the Kit Kat Club? She should be headlining on Broadway. You don't have to belt it, but you do have to sing it rather better than I'm afraid she can. You can feel the disappointment at the end of maybe this time. People going, oh, that was quite good.
One point, she was apparently really ill on that first night, and I'd like to see it again. I mean, she was struck down with a virus. Now, sometimes these things are said that they're not necessarily true, but I would really like to see it again, because I reckon if she could just sing a bit more powerfully, it might be a really great cabaret.
Yeah, she missed the last three previews and then came
and she
back.
Had a temperature of 104 the night before. So we may be...
I take it back. But
so we may be being very unfair, Bonner. Yes. But on the other hand, maybe if it was that bad, they should have postponed the press night. You know, it's not... but I reckon with 40% more behind the voice, because we know she can act. She's a wonderful actress.
Yes.
But, you know, actress. If there was just a bit more vocal power, I think she'd be sensational, because the vulnerability is wonderful.
It isn't just the belting, though. You want... when Natasha Richardson played that role on Broadway in Sam's production...
She couldn't sing either.
She won a Tony, and she couldn't really sing, but I have to say, she was far and away the best Sally Bowles I've seen in any production. And... there was a quality of vulnerability, and there was a texture. That's the word that I'm looking for. It's a texture. It's not about I'm going to belt to the last row of the theater. It's just something indefinable that exudes a confidence which I didn't feel Anna Maxwell Martin had.
I think that then that creates problems between her and Cliff, because you watch her in the club, and clearly she can't deliver in the club. So they're following that strand of the production. At which point you go, in which case, the connection between him that makes him want to marry her in order that they can grow, bring the child up together, and because he at some level loves her, we need to see that. And actually, I didn't believe that she was a posh girl from Chelsea for one second. I felt that the accent was completely affected. And she walks on playing the nervous breakdown that Sally hits at the end of the play at the beginning of the show. And I just didn't believe that relationship for a moment. It leaves him stranded. To my mind, he overacts like mad in order to make up the vacuum that's on the stage. And it just... nothing coalesces.
That sense of vulnerability you were talking about, Matt, is I'm sure what Judi Dench would have brought to it when she did it first in London, which we're all too young to have seen.
I would love to have seen it. I really would. In a way, she seems absolutely perfect because that husk in her voice, which of course has defined her career, is exactly the chink in the armor that Sally Bowles has to have, sort of Natasha Richardson captured.
Cabaret, of course, quite a contrast to Spamalot, and quite a contrast again to Caroline Will Change, which is now at the National. David, you've seen Caroline Will Change in New York and here. Are there any differences?
For me, there aren't that many differences. There's two or three performances carried over from New York, notably Tonya Pinkins in the lead, an extraordinary performance by any measure. And she has a great big number. It's the 11 o'clock number, basically. It's like Rose's Turn in Gypsy. It's phenomenal, and she brings the audience to their collective feet. It's a really remarkable moment. But for me... You know, there were little things that were different. Anna Francolini is funnier than Vianne Cox, but doesn't have the same emotional weight. You know, there's sort of swings and roundabouts. I was left with the fact that I admire the show's ambition much more than I admire the show. I think it's trying incredibly hard. There are all sorts of problems with it for me that I think I would probably end up forgiving if I thought the score was better than... it is. The score feels to me like a lot of pastiche that never really finds its own voice, and as a result, it sort of sits there doing a lot of things rather well. There's one fantastic scene at Hanukkah with Hilton McRae being very good as the father, and you basically have a sort of a major family conversation set to music. And at moments like that, it's very, very successful, but a lot of the other stuff... I wish it went further. I wish they'd all pushed each other harder and it were funnier and darker and richer and stranger.
Well, next to Janine Tesori's very lightweight score from before, Thoroughly Modern Millie, it's quite a revelation, I think. Charlie, it's a very eclectic score.
I think it's a fantastic score. I couldn't agree less, really, with that. And I just think it is pastiche, but it's wonderful pastiche. And it does Motown, it does Jewish klezmer music, it's soul. And with Tonya Pinkins singing it, the big numbers, I found it was absolutely thrilling. And I just reading the sort of preview pieces on this show, it all sounded like a bit of a worthy civics lesson to me, quite honestly. But I thought it absolutely lived on stage as something. It was unlike any other musical I'd seen before. I loved the idea of Clive Rowe coming on and singing Being a Washing Machine and a Bus and things like that. And it's just, it's bonkers, and it's got a huge heart and this great star performance in the middle. And she put me in mind of a mixture of Aretha Franklin and Janis Joplin. The power in that big final number is just unbelievable. And I think, for me, it's been the great musical success of the season, and it's sort of, I suspect it was just little more than a succès d'estime, wasn't it, in New York?
Yes,
I shouldn't think it does. And I think here it may well prove a runner, because I just think there's a terrific originality about it, and there's certainly no music this year so far I've seen which actually quite comes close to it, just for sheer originality. It is flawed. I don't think it's perfect. I think it harangues a bit, but it's just got a kind of life and a newness about it that nothing else has had.
When I interviewed Clive Rowe, he said to me that somebody sort of said that he was perfect for these roles, and he said, I'd hoped I'd come along in my career away from kitchen appliances and modes of transport. But it is that kind of show, isn't it, Matt, it really pushes the boat in terms of... I mean, there's also an embodiment of the radio with three singers.
Like the Supremes.
It is a genuinely different piece.
Absolutely, but only a playwright like Tony Kushner who could write a seven-hour self-described gay fantasia on national themes, i.e. Angels in America, would think of writing a show like this. And, I mean, yes, it's got problems, and some people don't find it moving, which I'm shocked by, because even talking about it, I find myself getting very emotional. But I think it's extraordinarily moving. I mean, quite crushingly moving, and it comes from such a sort of deep place. It's also, for all its heart and compassion, it's that rare show that actually puts anger center stage. And Caroline is a woman pretty much defined by anger and rage and fury, and it's absolutely uncompromising. And fascinatingly, with relation to the title, she doesn't change. And although this irked the New York critics, again, peculiarly, because they want musicals like Wicked to be about change. What did Glinda and Elphaba say at the end of Wicked? Because I knew you, I have been changed for good. That's very nice. That doesn't always happen in life. Not everyone changes. Change will happen in this show, and it'll be the next generation, her daughter. But for Caroline, she is locked in this place from which she will probably never move on. And it is quite an extraordinary thing to witness. So for all the problems of the show, which I can seed exist, I think it's far and away the musical of the season.
Tonya Pinkins actually told me, as again in another interview, that she drew originally Far and a Great Well of Anger in her own personal life to play it originally, and she has indeed changed since then, and now she's playing it very much more as a kind of dramatic exercise. But I mean, she played it for real.
She's still amazing. Yeah, she's no matter what she's drawing on. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those
brave
performances people will be talking about forever.
Yeah, it's so brave for an American musical, where they always feel the obliged to soften it normally at the end. And this is a music that stands on this great note of defiance that she won't do it, you know. And there's something kind of heroic about it. Also, it's so personal, obviously. It's about him as well, because the boy in it is so moving as well, I think.
Yeah.
And the whole metaphor of change, and change in the pocket and the social change, very cleverly handled. I mean, this is superior stuff. It may not always work, but it aims really high.
But also the context, and I don't know how much of this resonates in Britain, but the context within American culture of the black mammy figure and the white person who's in the position of authority, whether 11 years old or 111 years old, as replicated in things, everything from Gone with the Wind to Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, I mean,
this is
life.
Absolutely, this is such a constant, and this musical stands it on its ear. And the remarkable scene near the end between the young boy Noah and Caroline, when he's trying to make amends, and she says to him, "Weren't never friends."
That is the best scene.
An amazing, amazing line, "Weren't never friends." Because it would be so easy to say, "Oh, yes."
And actually, that is also the moment where the music is most interesting, where he sings Caroline back, back, back. And it suddenly becomes like a child's counting song, and it's full of all the emotional resonances that have been set up. I don't want to sound like I'm going completely back on what I said, because I still stand by my position, but what I would like to do is clarify that, to say that I think it's not as... it doesn't meet its ambitions, but I absolutely recognise what everybody else is saying, which is that its ambitions are so far ahead of every other musical, as Charlie says, that we've seen this year, that I do, of course, applaud it. It's because it sets standards for itself that are that high. I'm being critical because if you're going to set yourself that high, I think you need to achieve more of it. I think the production is weak. I think the design is scandalously weak. It's sort of not very interesting. It needs to cohere more. But, yes, Tonya Pinkins is quite extraordinary, and she couldn't be that extraordinary if material were second rate. It's not that material's second rate. It's, I don't know, I want it to be as good as it could be, and I don't think it is.
You want the stars, which is a nice thing to want, you know what I mean?
I think it's interesting that it's being done at the National. It's the sort of show that has to be done at the National. You would not.
Why was this? My question is, why didn't Nick Heitner say, by all means bring Tonya Pinkins, but let's do a new production. Let's do a British version of this show.
Do you think George Sigel wanted to hold it?
I'm sure he wouldn't.
A single minute.
Yeah. But he's a stubborn man, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
But then that begs the question, why is the National doing a New York transfer?
Because this musical needed seeing, and it would never have been done in the West End.
And also Janine Tesori wrote music for Nick Heitner's Twelfth Night.
Yeah, but let's not be too cynical about it, because I think in a way, I don't care who's directing it, it's exactly the kind of show the National should do, because...
Yeah.
In New York, because the theatrical ecology in New York is so ridiculous, they couldn't run it on at the Public where I saw it, where it absolutely sold out. They had to move it to Broadway. It took 97 producers to move it to Broadway, knowing, of course, as they did so, that it would lose every penny, which it did, and not run, which it did not. I think it actually, a couple of people said in the press, ran 38 performances. It ran more than that. It ran about 5 months. But it needs this sort of subsidized theatrical context.
But I'm fascinated to know why it didn't run in New York, because it does say something about New York, it seems to me, that. I mean, this is, you know, it's much more New York.
Because it's not, I would say in one sense, because it's not redemptive. It doesn't give you... Yes, it satisfies discerning theatre-goers, but it doesn't give you the easy, instant kick. You know, if everybody loves Wicked, everybody loves the resolution between Glinda and Elphaba, which is a Hallmark card. It's entirely unearned, but it gives you that, and to its utter credit, this show refuses to do that.
It's frightening in a way, because the more you do this job, you can end up despising audiences, can't you? But liking rubbish and not going to the stuff that really is worthwhile.
That's a whole other topic, actually, Charlie, for a very interesting discussion. I think that does actually happen in New York.
And it may well be coming up in Dirty Dancing.
And indeed it is, because this is a show that...
I might be despising critics.
A show that the audience do love, Dirty Dancing, opened to a £12 million advance, the highest advance in West End history. David, is that earned?
Well, I would, of course, would question whether or not audiences love it. The fact that it's got a 12 million advance has got nothing to do with whether audiences love it. No. It's got to do everything to do with audiences love the title. It's a fantastic piece of marketing. It's about expectation. There's £12 million worth of expectation. Now, it's about to announce that its booking period is going to book into 2008, because the first booking period is entirely sold out. You cannot get in till May, and then booking is currently open till October. It's going to extend again any minute now. The point about this show is that it is a very, very strange thing. It's not a production. It's a reproduction. You have every shot from the movie. There are something like 85 scenes in this stage production.
Over 50 songs.
And you get shot for shot. Now, the problem is, in the movie, you had Patrick Swayze with very few clothes on. That's fine to look at, particularly in lovingly lit, beautiful close-up. Joseph Brown has a great body, but you can't see it in close-up. And also, the other problem is that in 96 minutes, the movie delivers. 2 hours and 20 plus an interval, it's really torpid until the last 10 minutes. I'd be surprised if audiences are having a really great time at this, unless they're tanked up to the skies and on a hen night.
The interesting thing is that our jobs are rapidly being usurped by the Vox Pops thing. In those free papers, the London paper and the Evening Standard Light, they reprint user reviews, and for the public... are saying it's the greatest thing they've ever seen, and they want to go again, and they want to take their family and their babies. I mean, these are reviews I've actually read already from the public. So clearly, it does seem to be striking some kind of popular nerve.
Well, I don't know. Is it really? And what are they seeing? Are they actually seeing the show, or are they just reliving images from the movie and grafting those onto the show as this, in my view, endless, boring, stupefying, inept, inert, processional limps across the stage. And Charlie was talking about despising audiences. I read some of the overnight reviews and I started despising the critics, because I thought it's actually shocking, and there's no more polite word, in the same 7-day period as Carolina Change, which is in every way the antithesis to this show, including the fact that Carolina Change is set either side of the Kennedy assassination in the South in 1963. This is set very particularly in the innocent summer of 1963, before America was traumatized forever. But has nothing to say about it, except that they can show an image of Martin Luther King for 30 seconds so that this show has a social conscience? I thought, come on. And then I read three reviews the next morning that gave it 4 stars from people who, quite frankly, should know better. I mean, I was just astonished. This isn't a show. It's an exercise in merchandising.
Absolutely, and you can buy the T-shirt in the foyer as you can. What I loved at Spamalot was, as you came down to the stalls, it was ye old rippy offy shop. At least they're honest to their intentions.
I didn't see it, but it's interesting, this procession of movies going onto the stage, and it's a built-in audience, isn't it? For some reason, it's unthreatening.
But this is a really interesting variant on that genre, because unlike The Producers, which, whatever you think of it, I liked it a lot, it rethinks the movie, and it adds to the movie, and it embellishes the movie, and it takes the movie and brings it somewhere else.
It makes Mary Poppins look like the most radical piece of theatre staging you've ever seen.
This brings nothing, and it's so shockingly badly directed. There are endless scenes where they're just blackouts, and the actors sort of look left and right and don't know what to do, and then they just walk off stage.
So let's get up close and personal about this. Why did it get the good reviews? What were people... I mean, I was
astonished.
Because
people are cowed. I think people are seriously cowed. They go, it must be good. I don't wish to be seen to be an old git. I don't want to be seen saying it's terrible when my editors will turn around and say, but 12 million people have booked. I think people are seriously cowed by those reviews and they should be ashamed of themselves.
And a lot of betrayal of the job, though, isn't
completely.
It?
Completely.
It is quite shocking. And a lot of best reviews were, and put whatever spin on this you want, from some of the older critics who I think didn't want to be seen to be out of touch.
Correct.
But if you've been reviewing theater for 35 years, surely you can see a production that hasn't been directed.
And somebody said, brilliantly staged. And you go, no, it's not. Stephen Brimson Lewis's set has a double revolve and some hydraulics and four projection screens. Now, Stephen Brimson Lewis is a very, very estimable designer, and actually, he's done a good job in the sense that he has managed to reproduce the 85 different setups that there are in the film. And that's not a random number, that's the number. And to do that, that is very neat and clever. It is not brilliantly staged. It is merely adequate, and it makes you realise the difference between theatre and film. You know, you can leap from one location to another in a nanosecond, in a single edit. Here you have to laboriously go from place to place, and as Matt says, people stand on stage and they drift off because the stage is revolving and bringing up a walkway in order that we can have a 5-second scene in which somebody is walking to the hut where they go to see the Dirty Dancing, because Eleanor Bergstein has decided that every single moment from her movie that she wrote and hawked around Hollywood for 10 years and then turned into a blockbuster, now that she's written the script, every moment from that film must now be on the stage. It's preposterous.
I'm also glad you mentioned Eleanor Bergstein, because as an American Jew myself living in London, I was scandalized additionally by the complete de-ethnification of the material. This is set in the Catskills, people. I mean, the Catskills is echt Jewish. Why has Jackie Mason been coming to Britain all these years but to give a little hint of that to British pop culture? And this is the waspiest, most white bread representation of the Catskills ever. And I saw it with another American Jewish friend of mine who lives near me in American Jewish North London. And we just sat there gobsmacked looking at the stage.
And there is some truly dreadful acting.
Quite a lot.
So it won't be travelling to Broadway, or do we think it will?
Oh, no, it will. It will.
It will. It will. But I will bet you any amount of money, and I would put money in this now, it's going to get a very different critical response there in New York.
It's going to go to Toronto, and then possibly on to Broadway. But this is the pattern. It did it in Australia. Now, Australia has a smaller market than London. It's much more finite. But it did explosive advance. And then it did its run. Germany broke all box office records, but interestingly, that's not, you know, it's not a runner. It doesn't have the legs, because I just don't think it delivers enough. I mean, it makes Footloose look like, I'm thinking, maybe I had a good time at Footloose after all.
Actually, it's so funny you say that, because I have not seen Footloose, and I came out of Dirty Dancing, sat at the front, and I went, maybe I should have seen Footloose instead.
Which is on the same block.
It's horrible seeing those two shows there. I mean, I saw them coming past, and those are two really fine theatres. I mean, Cameron's put all that money into the Novello. You've got the Old, which used to have the RSC in it.
The RSC are coming back. The RSC have a contract to go back 3 months for the next 5 years. They'll be in there with...
Yeah, but it's not, you know what I mean? You see those two shows next to each other, both based on...
Dirty Dancing and We will be coexisting for a long time, I have a feeling.
So I'll get a chance to see it and review it then.
Yes. Yes, yes.
On that note, thank you, David, Charlie and Matt.